Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, week one, Monday Night Football edition, and we waited about 7 months. Week one thus far, the National Football League did not disappoint. I'm your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider. And Payne, it's good to have professional football back, so our Sundays, they are officially taken out of commission from now until February.
For the first Monday podcast, you came out of the shoot there with a little phlegm. Everything okay this morning?
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to clear my throat. You have to build that stamina up. When you spend 14 hours on a Saturday watching college football, you follow that up with, you know, a 12 to 14 hour day watching NFL football. The reality of it is none of us are in midseason form, a lot like some of the quarterbacks and offenses that we watched week one that operated in fits and spurts.
What a tough life telling our listeners that you had to watch football back-to-back days.
Hold on a second here. I'm not complaining about it. I said I just have to build up my stamina. It's tough to stay awake for that long when you got to watch a bad product on Saturdays.
I did the mistake of staying up for the Baylor game and watching four missed kicks lead us to disastrous territory. But Sunday was much better, a real sport with guys that can execute, aside from kickers.
Yes, their kicking turned into a lot more of a fiasco than we ever anticipated in the NFL. That's for sure. Before we get things started, for those folks that are new to the Monday podcast, we kind of go through everything that we saw unfold already through the first 15 games thus far of week one. We'll poke around with some of the look-ahead lines, hit on those relatively quickly, and of course, a Monday Night Football preview for the Broncos and Seahawks. But I do want to thank all of you, our loyal listeners, that did sign up for the Bet the Board football contest this year. It was a late push. It was strong, and hopefully you reap the benefits from all those preseason previews, not just for our contest, but everything else that you're competing in this season. All right.
Other thing we should address before we get into this.
You want to talk about the Apple SoundCloud issue, or where are you going?
There you go. Way to lead us as the host into the right territory here.
Lay it out there for us.
So we're currently having some issues with SoundCloud and Apple Podcast, iTunes, and a slew of others communicating. It's now been 5 days, so it's making us a little nervous that this problem isn't just a tiny issue and we're navigating the landscape and figuring out how to address this issue. But for now, I know it's not convenient because I also like to listen to my podcasts on Apple, but we post this numerous places. So Spotify had no issues, Stitcher had no issues, Google Podcasts had no issues, and we always put the podcast up on the website, bettheboardpodcast.com. So it's not convenient. However, there are other places to listen to it than Apple. And just think about that as we get things sorted out. On to the stuff that matters.
All right. I'm glad you got the PSA out there because I know, hey, look, the podcast did so well. Listenership was so strong for the first week that it's almost like we got blackballed right out of the gates to try and set all that up. But all right, into the football items, the good, the bad, and the ugly. You want to kick things off with the good because we are the model of positivity on Monday mornings?
Always positive on Monday mornings. I think it's obvious, right? New York Giants. Did you know I was going to go there? Was that an easy?
I probably would have made them about $1.30 favorite. I should have been a little bit stronger in that regard, but I figured every now and again you throw me for a loop. And there was also a chance that it could have been the Miami Dolphins as well.
No. Didn't love what I saw there. But the Giants, I thought all things considered, right? You're almost a touchdown road dog. Trailed out of the gates by 2 scores that could have easily given up, but I liked what they showed battling back there, and I think you have to praise Mr. Daboll there. Big balls decision to go for 2 late and take the lead. Did require some field goal luck at the end, but I think the process was right, and the one thing that you would read first thing Monday morning or late Sunday evening was the guys in the locker room were super happy about the aggressiveness and that Daboll kind of laid out the game plan Saturday night that they were going to be aggressive and he wasn't going to coach scared. And I think that was awesome for the locker room, and I think it was obviously good for the New York media. But the one thing that was very interesting to me, and we said it 6 weeks ago, and it was at the time where everyone was yelling about his contract and if he'd be part of the organization moving forward. We said Saquon Barkley would be a massive part of this offense. And it wasn't just the 18 carries, but he ran 25 routes. That was more than Galladay. It was more than Shepard. And then you throw every single running back into a pot this week. Barkley was number one in rushing yards over expectation per attempt. He approached nearly 5 yards per attempt over expectation. No other back was above 3.5 yards. So very good start for the Giants. Do have to keep an eye on that wide receiver room. I saw that Tony's still kind of working his way back. The Wandell Robinson issue, he suffered a knee, did not return. And then obviously Kenny Galladay just looks like he's cooked. So it'll be interesting to see how that wide receiver room shapes up as the season goes along.
Just get Barkley 35 touches a week. What could possibly go wrong for the Giants there? Get it to your explosive playmaker. And to your point, Brian Daboll, a hell of an aggressive game plan late. I love the fact that he went over to his defense and basically told them, hey, we're going for two. Everybody was on board. And yes, it did take a little field goal luck for them to get the outright win, a couple defensive penalties there. And Daboll also had to get in Daniel Jones's face for what was a terribly thrown ball into the end zone. But the Giants, for the first time since the infamous trip down to Miami before the playoff loss to the Packers, I believe, see themselves at 1-0, a fan base that has suffered quite a bit over the last couple of years. I'm going to take a cop-out here, Payne, from the good, because I'm going to applaud the entire league. When we have 7 game-tying or go-ahead scores in the final 2 minutes of regulation, it reminds you how difficult it is just to pick the outright winners in this sport and why it's so important, obviously, to get the best of the number there. Yes, these games weren't all point spread drama, but depending on where you fell on the fence for Cleveland and Carolina, I mean, there could have been a number of different fortunes that swung on that particular game. And I think as a result, I want to go towards Baker. He wasn't great yesterday, but he put together a perfect passer rating in the fourth quarter. In my opinion, it was clock management that let him down a little bit. So when I look at Carolina, if Matt Rhule continues to put together game plans that are this anemic, he may as well send his resume to Lincoln, because he should be on the short list for the Cornhuskers when he can't hack it in the National Football League.
I hear Matt Campbell is the leading candidate for that job.
It makes a ton of sense for your boy. He can recruit the same footprint. There's a lot more money in the Big Ten. There are significantly more resources, but you wonder what he's got to accomplish at Iowa State if he's got to go 6-6, 7-5, or maybe even 8-4 to allow the Cornhusker faithful to get behind him.
So let me get this straight. It's a Monday. It's our very first recap show. I give you the floor.
Yeah.
And you come out with Baker Mayfield as the positive during a losing performance. That was your foray into this.
Here's the thing. I mean, the reality of it is I could take the low-hanging fruit. I can go, you know what? New receivers, well, they all pay dividends week one with A.J. Brown, Devontae Adams, Tyreek Hill, and Christian Kirk all having big days. I can take the low-hanging fruit again with what we saw Thursday night from the Buffalo Bills, the preseason favorite to win the Super Bowl, who turn it over 4 times and still beat the defending Super Bowl champions by 100 points. They hold the Rams to less than 4 yards per play, less than 3 yards per carry, and Von Miller leads this defense to 7 sacks. But what fun is that? You have to go off the beaten path a little bit around these parts.
You mentioned some of the kicking woes this weekend, and I will go to a game that had some of those, but I think we give credit to a defensive staff, whether it was Mike Tomlin, whether it was Terrell, whether it was Flores. I thought the Steelers' defense was fantastic. That was another team that went on the road as a touchdown underdog, won outright, forced 5 turnovers, which obviously is difficult and not repeatable, but that's what it would take to win a game like that. And I look, Burrow didn't play his best, and I think that's probably putting it mildly. If you look heading into last night's games, the Sunday nighters, Burrow was pressured at the 6th lowest rate of any quarterback of the week, yet he was sacked 7 times for a 12% sack rate. Completion percentage was 3% below expectation. So he was trying to do a little bit too much, trying to push the ball deep downfield like they did a bunch last year. And that was the one thing he expressed this offseason, that they were going to have to matriculate the ball down the field because he was expecting a bunch of looks that would hinder the explosiveness, and yet they just held on to the ball forever and tried attacking downfield. So that was interesting to me, but you have to give kudos, I think, to the Steelers defense. And the other thing that you now look at this, and I understand some of the teams were very good, but this was a team that certainly made a little bit of a historic run, the Bengals, that is, and they upgraded the roster. We knew the schedule difficulty enhanced dramatically, the largest year-over-year increase in schedule difficulty. But the last three games now, down 21-3 to Kansas City, down 13-3 against the Rams, and trailing 17-3 at home against Pittsburgh. And this is why I believe professional bettors and odds makers view the Cincinnati Bengals a little bit differently than the public.
It's going to be an interesting team to watch. Joe Burrow definitely didn't look comfortable at any point, and I'm not sure if you attribute that to what you said. The Steelers doing things defensively that made him pause a little bit rather than utilizing a quick release. It's the fact he missed extended period of time with that appendectomy, but the Bengals dealt a fortuitous bounce, going to be a full touchdown favorite on the road against the Dallas Cowboys in week two. Alex Highsmith, obviously the highlight, one of them for the Pittsburgh Steelers defense, accumulates three sacks, and much more is going to be asked of him and the rest of that Steelers defense with TJ Watt being shelved for an extended period of time coming up. Since you told me I didn't do anything right as far as... That's not what I said.
Don't put words in my mouth.
Speaking of which...
You came out of the gate with Baker.
With Baker. I mean, I like to celebrate the underdog. But speaking of turnovers, by the way, Payne, the fact that you say the Steelers can't repeat that five-turnover performance, that's not what social media told me on Saturday night watching college football, so let it be known.
Oh, interesting. Oh, yeah. Acho?
Emmy
Award winner?
You know defenses can rely on forcing turnovers inside the 3-yard line, and that is a fail-proof strategy for defensive success.
This was the USC defensive debate, and that was something I actually tweeted out, and this is an NFL podcast. So
well, we'll get to that. No, that's a teaser. That's a teaser in the business. We'll get to that on Wednesday to try and break that down. I don't want to get off topic.
There we go.
For what we're doing there. All right, then I'm here. I'm going to give you the easy, right down the middle, 92-mile-an-hour fastball in a 3-0 hitter's count. Justin Jefferson accounting for 184 receiving yards in his Minnesota Vikings debut. Obviously, Kevin O'Connell has a new toy that he can plug and play, similar to the mold of Cooper Kupp, the difference being that Justin Jefferson is an absolute athletic freak. 9 catches on 11 targets, included a 64-yard big play over the top, and he basically was all of the Vikings' passing offense in their season-opening win against the Packers.
Yeah, I don't really think we get too far into the metrics, but more of the overarching stuff that we discussed this offseason, and that the vibe around the organization and in the locker room was vastly different with Kevin O'Connell than it was with Mike Zimmer. And all the players mentioned that they loved O'Connell and how he was handling the offseason, and that they would go very, very hard for like 2 days, 3 days, and then they would just kind of relax the rest of the week, get their bodies right. And we know that teams got some veterans, especially on the defensive side, but it was a good start for the new look Vikings offense, right? And all of the leaders, Cousins, Jefferson, Thielen, all had high praise for the coach even after the game. Cousins basically said the plays now offensively make sense. They're running together. We were aggressive and built the lead, and that helps. One of the best home field advantages going in the league. Justin Jefferson said the offense made him feel like a kid on Christmas, and then Thielen credited the staff with having an attacking mindset. Let's see what this looks like Monday night when defenses now have film, and that was one of the things that we did mention in our breakdown of Vikings-Packers, that DeAndre Campbell, the green dot for the Packers, said, we're not really sure what to expect here the first quarter and a half. And Thielen intimated the same thing, that, you know, it felt like the Packers weren't quite sure of what was going on offensively, but now there's film, and let's see if Kevin O'Connell can make some adjustments and kind of add new wrinkles and elements to the offense.
It's just nice for Vikings fans, I have to imagine, to not be involved in a one-score game late. They could actually put their feet up for the final 5 minutes of a fourth quarter, something that they couldn't do last year with 14 games being decided by one possession.
You are correct about that. It was fun to be on an over win total for the Vikings where you just didn't have to sweat the late game stuff.
All right, what else?
Last thing for good here, sure, before we maybe transition to some of the negative stuff.
Yep, that works.
What do you think about Reed Mahomes?
I mean, I didn't have any concerns about Reed Mahomes like everybody else did. People wanted to try and eulogize him. They had one foot in the grave that how could this offense possibly function without Tyreek Hill? We've seen it time and time again. Patrick Mahomes during the month of September is an absolute freight train coming down the tracks, and he's even better in week one, where this team now averages more than 37 points per game. Mahomes has yet to throw an interception in 5 season openers, and he's thrown 18 touchdown passes. I mean, they could have hung 70 on the board in that particular game if they wanted to attack aggressively, but they could take their foot off the gas in the middle of the second quarter because Arizona was so inept.
I don't think much of the Cardinals' defense, and we kind of discussed that all last year where they're playing well above expectation, and then they lost some guys this year, and they were really beat up. But you still have to go out there and play. Mahomes' completion percentage, 9% over expectation. Didn't take a sack, but was pressured a bunch. That's maybe the one area of concern with this offense is we know Wiley at right tackle as Lucas Niang recovers from his knee injury last season. And Orlando Brown, I think, is probably the most overrated left tackle in this league. Allowed 7 pressures himself. But you look at the offense. Everyone was involved. And I think that's probably the difference is the parts, the depth, the quality of passing options for Patrick Mahomes to toss the ball to isn't just Tyreek Hill. 10 different receivers were targeted. 4 different running backs had a carry. And then you look at the rookies, Pacheco, McDuffie, and Karlaftis. They all contributed. Pacheco is Kansas City's most efficient runner in terms of EPA. McDuffie wasn't targeted at all. They didn't throw his way. And then Karlaftis, 14% pressure rate on pass rush snaps. Certainly a big game this Thursday that we'll break down. But interesting start for the Chiefs, to say the least.
And I don't want this to be taken out of context because it's not meant as a jab or anything along those lines. What the Chiefs' offense yesterday reminded me of was those vintage Patriots teams where it's, to your point, the sum of the parts. Yes, you had the Randy Moss era that didn't last that long. You always had a relatively elite tight end that you could lean on. Rob Gronkowski took things to the next level. That's Travis Kelce. And then defenses have no idea where Mahomes is going to go with the ball. And to Mahomes' credit, he said coming in, hey, fantasy managers are going to be disappointed because it's going to be a different guy every week. In my opinion, yes, Tyreek Hill is a game breaker. We know what he means to that offense or meant to that offense. But when you're a defensive coordinator and you don't know what to take away, that can be as scary a premise as anything else, especially if there's backfield depth on top of it.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. And again, the nugget we mentioned on last week's show as we broke the game down, since 2018, Patrick Mahomes, when Tyreek Hill is off the field, still number 2 in EPA per dropback. So it's going to be interesting. This is the big game Thursday night. We'll see where those two division foes are at in terms of their quest for another championship run.
If we go from good to bad, Payne, is it too easy to take pot shots to the San Francisco 49ers and the 19-0 run that they allowed the Chicago Bears, albeit a game played in less than optimal conditions, but at the same time, we continue to see this Niners team struggle to get straight-up wins when Kyle Shanahan is operating without Jimmy Garoppolo under center?
Nice of you to include them in the bad category, because I had them in the ugly category.
Oh, I think you could take them in both if you wanted, so this was easy. They were going to get mentioned one way or another.
I think there's growing pains, obviously, when you have a quarterback that just turned 22. The situation obviously wasn't perfect with nasty weather, and you think about Trey Lance in general, right? He's a guy who played in a dome in college, and he doesn't have a ton of experience. And then Elijah Mitchell, who was the key to the 49ers game plan, left early with a knee injury. And we knew that going in because Trent Williams was talking to one of the reporters about the game plan for some reason. It was like, going to be a lot of Elijah Mitchell today. And like, poof, he's out after like a quarter and a half. But Trey Lance was horrific, right? Missed open guys. His eyes weren't very good. It led to easy picks. He took sacks when he shouldn't have. Lance was really hesitant as a runner too. And all told, that's how you blow a double-digit lead. Right now, depending on what transpires this evening, and Geno Smith is always an option for this, but Lance right now, worst completion percentage compared to expectation. 21% below expectation. Accuracy is still an issue. Let's see if that gets cleaned up. We'd kind of heard this offseason that some of the yak stuff might not be there for this offense because the precision ball placement isn't quite there with Trey Lance yet. But we expect the explosiveness to increase. We'll see if that does in better weather. And of course, George Kittle was out as well. So a lot of things can change from week to week. And I think ultimately we'll see a little bit better performance upcoming from Trey Lance.
All right. I led you in one direction. Now I'm going to give you the floor for carte blanche. What did you have classified in the truly bad category for what we've seen?
I think there was two. And one may be a little surprising because road wins aren't easy, but the Eagles' defense was horrific. And I know the Lions O-line is probably one of the more respected O-lines, and that's a group that we just love. And they had about 3.5 starters at full health. Javon Hargrave and Fletcher Cox were bad. Among qualifying defensive tackles, Hargrave and Cox grade out two of the worst three interior linemen in terms of EPA per rush allowed. This does also feel like a scheme thing, right? We're now on 18 games into the Jonathan Gannon defensive experiment, and we're constantly questioning the scheme, the game plan. I remember last season, right? It was the secondary not playing aggressively enough after the Raider game where Derek Carr completed what felt like every single pass. And then you have the entire offseason to prepare for one opponent of which you played last season, and you're giving up 35. And here's the kicker. The Eagles gave up 35 points to an offense with a quarterback that finished with a completion percentage 11% below expectation and had the third worst intended air yards versus completed air yards conversion of the entire week. So a little nervous there for the Eagles defense. The other one's obvious, right? The Cowboys offense last night in the late game was horrific, and we thought it could be. Too many players have either left or are injured, right? And prior to Dak's injury, his completion percentage 17% below expectation, the worst mark for any quarterback not named Lance or Fields, but Dak didn't play in a monsoon. He played in a dome. We had heard some rumors this week, and there were some lies being spewed about from that organization that Dak had this midweek scare where he heard a pop in his surgically repaired ankle. And he claimed it was these new cleats, right? Now they're saying it was fine. It was just scar tissue loosening. Obviously, unfortunately, now Dak is injured. He's got the thumb injury. It's going to require surgery. He's out 6 to 8 weeks. Connor McGovern went down with an ankle injury. But this is really a simple equation here. Like, Mike McCarthy is below average. Dak isn't elite. And the offensive line and receiving weapons have just lost too much, right? Injuries, trades, free agency, retirement, whatever it is, those two units of the Cowboys, the O-line, the receiver group, are just really, really bare right now. And this is why the Cowboys were a full-blown fade for us coming into the season.
Hey, 0-1, and they're staring down the Cooper Rush era taking off in earnest. If you're the Dallas Cowboys, 1+1 did not equal 3 on opening night. And if you start to get off the rails early, maybe, just maybe, you put yourself in the sweepstakes for Will Anderson and the number one overall pick to potentially fortify that.
You like questions like this, so I'm going to push it back on you.
Okay, I'm ready for this. Let's see.
If Dak is out 6 to 8 weeks, are you going to make a move for Jimmy G, and do you think after the week one performance, Jimmy G is still available?
So I'll go a couple layers on this. If I'm Jerry Jones, knowing where I'm at with the current construction of my roster, I'm picking up the phone. I'll ask the 49ers what the potential is for Jimmy Garoppolo. At the same time, I'm not Jerry that I believe this team can win the way it's constructed and that Jimmy Garoppolo somehow gives me a lot more than a puncher's chance. So if Dak is out 6 to 8 weeks, I'm going, okay, we're going to do the best we can. We're going to figure it all out, but I'd almost want to break it all down. I also think the price for Jimmy Garoppolo, if you're the 49ers, went up substantially, and I do believe that Kyle Shanahan, when he goes home most nights and puts his head on the pillow, wonders what could have been if that organization allowed him to draft Mac Jones instead of Trey Lance.
I like it. I don't know if Cooper Rush can keep you in the playoff hunt after starting 0-1 if he's your quarterback for the next potentially 8 weeks.
I mean, I'm trying to think, too, if it's not Jimmy, I mean, who else theoretically could be out there if they wanted to try and acquire a backup quarterback?
One of the guys from Seattle?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you pick up the phone, you try and see what the ask is for Drew Lock. I mean, I don't even know if that's
there's not a lot of good options right now.
I mean, I guess you could also go to Indy and see if Nick Foles is available.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think my whole take on this, and yes, it's different in the NFL, it's only one game, you don't want to overreact, but I didn't think this Cowboys, to your point, was good enough to win even with Dak. Do I want to give up any semblance of draft capital to chase the dream if I realize that, hey, 1-6, 1-7, it won't sit well with Jerry, it won't sit well with fans or season ticket holders, but it may not be the worst thing to allow the Cowboys to get another difference maker in the top 10 in the draft.
I completely agree with you. I think our sentiment of the Cowboys is, at this point, if Dak's out 8 weeks, let's just think about next year. Jerry doesn't have as much time as we do, and he thinks much higher of his team than I think most rational humans do.
Yep, I think
you did mention Mac Jones, by the way. Let's kind of finish the ugly section here.
Okay.
with the Patriots. What did you make of that offense?
What was there to make of that offense? I mean, I didn't see much to be excited about. We had questions coming in terms of what that group was going to be able to do. And I'm not sure there is a silver lining because you look at that offense in totality. Mac Jones, I think we both believe in long-term. Is he going to be Josh Allen? No, not in my opinion, at least. But from an offensive line standpoint, there's not much in the way of building blocks there. The weapons in the backfield, I'll call them average with Ramondre Stevenson and Damian Harris. And the weapons on the outside in the receiver room are well below average. So this is a team that's going to have to go out there and grind out games in that 20-17 vein more often than not if they're going to be competitive. And unfortunately, the offense did what that offense can't do given its shortcomings. You can't allow the opposing defense to get a pivotal go-ahead touchdown to take that lead from 3-10, and it just kind of snowballed from there that Miami never really felt threatened.
Shame on us for clamming up and not taking under 47 because another group liked the over this past week. I spotted this issue day one of camp for the Patriots offense. We heard Mac Jones voicing his frustrations for multiple weeks leading up to the season. It was the combination of Matt Patricia, a bad defensive mind calling offensive plays, with an O-line that's downgraded and was also learning a new blocking scheme and arguably the worst receiving core in the league. It's just like a massive list of bad problems. And now Mac Jones is dealing with a back injury. Fortunately, x-rays were negative. Let's see how things transpired, but that is the reason right now that Patriots game has a red circle on it because we're waiting on the status of Mac Jones.
Oh, some teams that come in where hope springs eternal. Some teams don't really give you that much to get excited about there. As far as other ugly, anything else that you wanted to touch on? I had one that I think a fan base is obviously irate given their week one result, but there is a silver lining to how the game actually unfolded.
Well, the Colts didn't lose. Is that where you're going?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, it would have classified as ugly given the final score, but you dig into that box score, there's plenty of reason for optimism with Indianapolis going forward. That game, despite erasing a 20-3 deficit, should never have been as close as it actually was.
Let's see what happens. This was a baby step, I think, for the Colts. How many home openers did they lose?
I mean, the Colts
eight,
now...
Eight straight prior to this game? Well, now, they didn't win it, but a push.
Yeah, it's now nine straight winless openers. Frank Reich has yet to win a season opener as head coach of the Colts.
I'm not sure what's going on there, honestly. I don't understand it because he's a really good game planner. Then knack on him, and we're being picky,
yeah, of
is how he clams,
that's what we do.
Clams up in the second half a little bit. But I can't wrap my head around the team not starting well, knowing that they start most games well. I believe they were the number one team in terms of holding a lead at halftime last season. So it's just bizarre that the season doesn't start fresh for them. And that was one of the things when we looked at the schedule, we said, hey, you got to start fast because the first 2 weeks they had a real opportunity to start 2-0.
The one thing I will give him, and it's not an excuse, sixth straight season opener, sixth brand new starting quarterback. So even when you have accomplished veterans like a Phillip Rivers and a Matt Ryan that are learning a new system, you do wonder if they're going to be growing pains. But I'll finish on this note for the ugly and Atlanta Falcons fans that are out there. Your performance was great. You exceeded oddsmakers' expectations and you covered the number. But this stat pain sent chills down my spine. The Atlanta Falcons, and this is courtesy of some of my research guys, I want them to dig into it at CBS. Falcons are 5-3 in games over the last three seasons where they led by 15 or more points in the fourth quarter. Care to venture a guess what the rest of the National Football League is during that span?
Probably pretty good.
244-2-1. The Falcons represent three of the five losses over the last 3 years where teams have blown a 15-point lead in the fourth quarter. That's hard to do.
They don't have a great defense and they can't really get pressure. So when you have a lead, being able to get pressure in these known dropback situations is vital, and they can't seem to do that. Plus, they haven't won a bunch of games. And so when you're not in those positions frequently, that's ultimately what transpires. I did like, from an offensive perspective, some of the things that went on in the game plan initially, and we thought that could be the case with Mariota, right? This offense was going to look vastly different. Arthur Smith said as much, that there's going to be more rollouts and bootlegs, and there's going to be things that nobody else saw. And Marcus Mariota was okay. I thought. Held on to the ball probably a little too long, almost 3 seconds per drop back. But you at least like to have seen them hold on to it. Drake London, questionable up until kickoff if he was going to play or not. I thought he had a fine opening. Pitts was kind of the odd man out offensively, which is a little bizarre.
A non-factor.
Wildly shocking there. But ultimately, I think Atlanta showed a little fight, and I'll just be candid. You and I had a discussion prior to the start of the season, and the Atlanta Falcons are a team that we bet under 5 wins, and we injected ourselves with truth serum and said, of all the futures that we have in the NFL that we made 2 months ago, whatever the timeline was, which ones do we hate the most now? I wouldn't say hate. I don't think we're in a terrible position, but the one I like the least was Atlanta at that point.
Hey, they showed fight. It was the Jameis Winston bailout program. Barely 50-plus passing yards for the first 3 quarters. He goes full-blown nuclear in the fourth, taking advantage of the return of Michael Thomas, getting Jarvis Landry involved, and the public darling to upstage the Tampa Bay Bucks in the NFC South is able to stave off an upset loss in their season opener. Want to encourage all of you
Jameis
guys.
Jameis was good, by the way. Number 2 in completion percentage above expectation, was super aggressive pushing the ball downfield, completed air yards 8.8. So give Jameis some credit, even though the initial game plan didn't look the best.
And I think that's the biggest concern. I don't know if that should be the positive takeaway. And I know we're getting way off topic in terms of the ugly, that the Saints were able to adjust on the fly, or that it took them being down 2 scores for them to take the governor off Jameis with a defensive-minded head coach in Dennis Allen.
Well, you think about them right now. A lot of guys getting implemented, right? Taysom Hill in a new role. Working back in Michael Thomas, who played primarily just on passing downs. I believe 35 total snaps, 33 of which were passing downs. Jarvis Landry's brand new. Chris Olave's brand new. So you do have some new components, right? You're still figuring out the left tackle situation. So there's some moving parts there still offensively for the Saints, even though we believe in totality that stock arrow up year over year on the Saints offense.
The month of September is always interesting as these teams try and figure out who they are and what their identity will be going forward. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You, of course, can follow me there as well. Most importantly, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. All right, Payne, real quick, as far as look-ahead lines, not nearly as many overreactions as you would anticipate from week 1 to week 2. Of course, the Cowboys and Bengals, that one is out of the equation. The Cowboys would have been a 2.5-point favorite if all things were equal. I think it would have opened shorter given that offensive ineptitude. We now see the Bengals open as a touchdown road favorite as the Cooper Rush era gets underway in earnest. So I don't want to harp on that. This game we'll cover on Thursday in great detail, but a little bit surprising that this game moved off of the key. The Chiefs go from 3 to 3.5. Of course, the Chargers lead receiver Keenan Allen, highly questionable, dealing with a hamstring injury on a short week.
One of the biggest half-point ticks there is around the 3. So we will see what transpires with this game. I'm a little surprised. I understand the offensive outburst the Chiefs had, but it's a short week, division game. Chargers defense was certainly upgraded. Some of the young parts for the Chiefs defense looked quite promising. This was a look-ahead total of 52.5, kind of gravitating away from the actual line. We're now at 54.5. Let's see if it gets to that key of 55. But again, I think Keenan Allen probably misses this game on short rest.
I would be shocked. Granted, there's a high level of importance placed on this. You can't afford to aggravate that injury further, knowing that your goal is to have Keenan Allen healthy from weeks 3 through 18, not just force him back on 72 hours thereabouts, despite being a high-profile road game against the Kansas City Chiefs. The Raiders, you talk about key numbers. This one actually blew through a key number. The Raiders were a 2.5-point favorite on the look-ahead for their home opener against the Arizona Cardinals. Arizona looks anything but capable or competent. You highlighted some of the defensive concerns. We now see the Raiders a 3.5-point favorite against Cliff Kingsbury and company.
The largest one-point move you can have in the NFL from 2.5 to 3.5. So let's see ultimately what the injury report looks like for the Cardinals. We know Zach Ertz was battling. J.J. Watt didn't end up playing. Rodney Hudson took on some limited, there were some center issues there. There were some offensive line issues. There were some weapon issues, cornerback issues. all of those are severe problems. Typically, the Cardinals, though, early in the season on the road, have been a pretty good proposition in the Cliff Kingsbury era. I'm interested to see where this goes, but it's an uphill battle for Arizona. I think we've kind of hit on this in that they need to be a fast-starting team. That's kind of been their MO the last few seasons. And the way the injuries were starting to stack up, the Hopkins suspension, it was going to be a problem early in the season. And so if you can't win early in the season, what's going to transpire late? And that's ultimately why this win total went from 9.5 down to 8.5. And I sent you a text message. Kyler Murray looks disinterested 15 minutes into the season.
You did. I wasn't going to divulge that nugget unless you were going to share. But yes, you definitely did.
I don't know, man. Like, he is just uber talented. It's very difficult to want to say, like, the quarterback position is so difficult. It's very, very tough to just move on from him. But boy, the body language, if I had to see that every single game and every single day, I don't know if I could put up with it. I really don't. You almost are just like, I got to move on. Instead, they paid him a chunk of money, and it's going to be Kyler Murray moving forward. And ultimately, there's plenty of time to get this rectified, and the injury bug should help. That should get improved. But interesting game here. I'm not quite sure where it will go from here. Obviously, again, the injury report will be vital to monitor for the Cardinals this week.
I think aloof would be the first adjective I would use to describe Kyler Murray in general, but who knew? You take away a PlayStation 5 from an NFL quarterback, he could go out there and be so disinterested in a season opener. A half-point move off a key, a full-point move through a key, and a field goal move from secondary number to secondary number is where it takes us for the Monday night game. That will preview 1 week from today when we have not one but two Monday night football games to break down. The Bills, 7-point favorites on the look-ahead, playing host to the Tennessee Titans with a little bit of revenge on their mind. The Titans lose to the Giants. The Bills blast the Rams on national TV, and here we are, the Bills, a double-digit favorite at 10.
I don't know if 10 is the right number. I really don't, but the Bills were uber impressive offensively. You can turn the ball over four times and still win by three scores. Buffalo is an offense right now that's humming and just has so many options. You can't just key on one guy. And that will be interesting to monitor moving forward because of how multiple this offense is. Now, I'll just be fully transparent. Friday morning, and it's not that I love betting after what we saw at one data point on national TV with everyone hyping them up, but the Bills, we laid 7 on the look headline, envisioning this would go much higher. I didn't anticipate Tennessee losing, but I knew the Giants were extremely sharp. Now we'll kind of reevaluate from now until Monday if that's something we're keeping. But just for full transparency, the Bills -7 was something we did bet on Friday on the look ahead.
Just push that number up to 10.5. Worst case scenario, we take 30% off the top and figure out what to do with it later. Come on, my friend. Take one for the team around these parts.
Appreciate the tips, Coach.
Hey, we do what we can. It's an educational street that normally runs 95% one way. Every now and again, I can send 5% back your way to imbue you with a little bit of wisdom. All right, enough look-ahead line chatter. Let's get into the Monday Night Football game tonight that'll see the Russell Wilson homecoming soiree get started in the Pacific Northwest. And this is a number that we saw during the offseason, open with Denver, a 3.5 to 4-point favorite, depending on where you shop. It got up to 7 as early as yesterday and through the morning. And we've since seen a little bit of buyback on the Seattle Seahawks. So we're going to call the Denver Broncos a 6.5-point consensus favorite in this football game. One-way traffic on the total from 41.5 up to 44. And when you talk about the number, Payne, I feel like that's the best place to start before we get into some of the X's and O's in this particular game, knowing that, hey, look, it's not just public money that drove this price up during the summer.
I hate to be the Grinch that stole the first Monday Night Football game of the season, but the number is the most interesting thing here. Obviously, you got to plug your nose and play Seattle, right? That's kind of the mindset. You're either doing that or you're off the game. Now, I will say this. Earlier this summer, a lot of sharp guys anticipated where this would be going. My understanding to this point is they haven't bought anything back, but those guys were laying 3.5, 4. They were laying a cheap money line, relatively speaking, because they anticipated where this game would go on Monday Night Football. They understood the vibe of the two teams, that Seattle was a sell, that Seattle was going to get a lot of negative publicity. However, yesterday morning, when a few 7s started to pop, some buy orders got sent. I was a little surprised with how early they went, and I would anticipate this have getting naturally to 7, but very smart, I guess, because now you're looking at 6.5 across the board, as you alluded to, even a couple sixes out there at some of the sharper shops. Let's see if this gets back to the key number, because it is going to be one-way traffic, especially once people get out of work. The total, I really respect the group that did go over on that again, but it was 2-3 weeks ago, and 44 is one of the most key numbers in the NFL.
All right, so that makes the handicap easy then. There's no value in the side. There's no value in the total. We just put the clapboards up on the window. We shut it down for NFL Week 1, and we start prepping for Wednesday's college podcast.
Like, it's very ugly, and I think if you have to take Seattle, like you have to have a 7 in front of it. You really do. I would have personally leaned, like, I would rather have Denver -4 than Seattle +7. Now, we can get into some of the things within this game and go from there if you would like.
Yeah,
where would you like to start? Well, it's not going to be a massive in-depth preview, but we can definitely hit both sides of the ball.
And look, let's be economical with our words as well. Instead of doing a Denver offense versus the Seahawks defense and vice versa there like we normally do for a lot of the marquee matchups, I want to get your take on the matchup you, as a football fan and a bettor, is most interested to watch, whether there are questions about a particular unit or it's strength on strength. Whatever the case may be, when you're watching this football game tonight, what are you most interested to see unfold?
There's a lot of little intricacies here. I think Seattle's defensive scheme and game plan is potentially what allows them to stay within this number. Certainly, it's not the Jimmys and Joes, because I don't see a ton of talent on the defensive side of the ball. You do have Clint Hurt, who's the Seahawks DC. He's from the Fangio tree. He was the outside linebackers coach in Chicago with Fangio. And the word is that Seattle's going to play a little bit more too high coverage, and they want to disguise what Jamal Adams and Quandre Diggs are doing. Like most quarterbacks, when they get that look, passes are shorter, and that's no different for Russ, right? His ADOT is shorter, his EPA per drop back is slightly worse against too high. So let's see what unfolds there. However, when I talk about the Jimmys and Joes, I'm a little worried, and this was a unit that we chronicled on the preview podcast. Seattle's secondary, in terms of coverage, makes me nervous. Like, you're looking at Mike Jackson. He's going to get the starting nod, apparently, over Sidney Jones tonight. He's a fifth-round pick of the Cowboys in 2019. He was plucked off the practice squad by Detroit that same year in 19. In 2020, he was with New England and then was on Seattle's practice squad for most of last season. He's played 30 total snaps in 3 seasons. He's going to be starting alongside a rookie in Tyreek Woolen for Seattle. We know what Adams is in coverage, so there's real question marks about what Seattle can do with their secondary. Denver's receivers are young, but certainly talented. I think Sutton has the potential for a big evening. 31% of his career targets have been downfield 20-plus yards. Albert O is going to be a matchup nightmare for Seattle's linebackers. The other problem here, Seattle was horrific last season defending running back passes. We know where Nathaniel Hackett comes from, over from Green Bay, where they like to get their running backs involved in the pass game. Seattle last year allowed a league high in both receptions and yards surrendered to running back passes. 127 receptions and over 1,100 yards. No one else was above 920 yards surrendered to running back. So that's interesting here. One element you want to kind of keep an eye on is Jordan Brooks. He is now the man in the middle for Seattle's defense. He's been given the green dot. That is one prop that took some sharp money. Over 8.5 tackles plus assists for Jordan Brooks. Last season, final game of the year, I believe he had 20, because he's got a new role in the middle of the field. He was accompanying Bobby Wagner last year and playing outside. He's going to get more snaps. So that was one prop that I thought was pretty sharp this evening that I did see come in. The other side of the ball, just quickly, right? You looking at the Broncos defensive coordinator, Evero. He's going against Shane Waldron, the Seahawks OC. They're two former Ram assistants, so there's a lot of familiarity there. We know Seattle wants to run the ball. That's just what Pete wants to do, and Denver was vulnerable last year. Bottom third of the league in defensive adjusted rush efficiency, but they went out, tried rectifying that issue, right? Went and got DJ Jones, signed him from San Francisco. He was the number one interior lineman in terms of run-stop win rate. You also have the matchup that everyone's probably going to talk about tonight is two rookie tackles, okay? That's the first pair of rookie tackles to start week one since the 1970 AFL-NFL merger. And so you're going to have Bradley Chubb and Randy Gregory going against Charles Cross and Abraham Lucas. let's see how that transpires. But that becomes a question mark if Denver can go out and build a little bit of a lead, and now you have Geno Smith forced to drop back in known passing situations with two rookie tackles.
I mean, the one thing that I will say in reading about this game, that Seattle continued to drum down people's throats, all the coaching staff, Pete Carroll included, kept saying is how fast this team is. No mention of skill, no mention of talent, just how fast, as if they're building a track team there. Doug Baldwin, former Seahawks great receiver, said that this reminds him a lot of the 2011 team in terms of breaking it all down before they have to build it back up. I mean, so many interesting things, but there is a bit of history on the line tonight, Payne. Do you happen to know what that is?
I don't.
Geno Smith has covered 8 straight games as an NFL starting quarterback. Now, that streak may go back to 2014 and may be completely irrelevant to the bottom line here, but Geno Smith has lined people's pockets on average once a year going all the way back to 2022. One last thing I want to ask
you about. Perception, right? That's the one thing, right? The point spread's the great equalizer.
There is no doubt
about it. So the more people that talk about Geno Smith and others negatively, it creates value in the market. It's very tough to do, but this is why on game day morning, when the limits are far and away higher than they were 2 months ago, you're seeing sevens come off.
That is
really respected money. Now, I will say this. There is an element here. And the guys that I spoke with that laid 4 2 months ago and, you know, some cheap money line on the Broncos, I think the place is going to be packed. It's obviously a home opener. Russ is returning. How do we really factor in home field advantage tonight? Because this is not an environment that Russell Wilson is, one, extremely familiar with, and two, it's probably not going to be too big of a moment for him. These sight lines, these grounds, he's used to them all, which is typically not the case for most people traveling to Seattle, and sometimes that 12th man can be pretty daunting task to overcome.
The level of familiarity, I think, helps, but I also feel it's human nature. When you haven't been in that role on the other side of the coin, it's going to be different. Like, Russ knows what to anticipate from how loud it is, and you hope he's able to work with the offensive line and figure it out, but suddenly you're now coming in a visiting uniform. Now, there also is the case to be made that the fan base could turn pretty quickly if Geno Smith struggles and find themselves rooting for the man on the other sidelines. So it'll definitely be interesting. The one question I did have on Denver's offense, and then we can wrap this up. The takeaway that I got from reading about this offense from some of the Denver Broncos beat reporters, they seem to indicate that the loss of Tim Patrick is a lot bigger to what this offense planned to do this season than anybody let on. For me, I look at Courtland Sutton. I see him as a true number one. I think Jerry Jeudy can be that as well. So do we think this is lip service, or I don't even know what to make of it when you're talking about Tim Patrick, like he's the second coming of Justin Jefferson.
He's old reliable. He is the guy analytics dudes gravitate towards because he is uber efficient. He's always in the right spot. He's just a consummate professional. He catches the ball when it's thrown to him. And that's ultimately the knock on this receiver group, whether it's Courtland Sutton, whether it's KJ Hamler, whether it's Jerry Jeudy. Sometimes they're just young and inexperienced. They're not always in the right spot. They're dropping balls. And Tim Patrick was kind of the inverse of those guys. He was just Mr. Reliable. So he was going to have quite the role. You also have Albert O, who is extremely talented. And I think that's kind of when you look at this receiving group, the ceiling's very high. The floor might be a little bit lower than you would like.
All right, that's a fair assessment when you look at these teams and how they're going to go about it. So either way, we have Monday Night Football back. It's exciting to watch. We give the NFL credit for sending Russell Wilson back to the place he put on the map in Seattle against his former head coach, Pete Carroll. So if the football game isn't great, the drama that comes along with it will be. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. Follow me there. Most importantly, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. And we have to reiterate, yes, we know SoundCloud and Apple not playing nice with one another, but there are a slew of other podcast platforms. So for the true Bet the Board listenership, make sure you're subscribed on Spotify, SoundCloud, Google Podcasts, everywhere else you can find podcasts. So if one platform goes down, you guys don't wander aimlessly into a pro or college football weekend. Any final words of wisdom, parting shots, nuggets you would like to share? Because I'm looking at the clock and I want to get out of here in under an hour, so you can't pick on me anymore.
That's everything. Little early season negative variance for the boys. We will get things on the right track here soon. Other than that, I think we've covered everything.
Field goal kickers, my friend. You can't live with them, and you can't kill them, unfortunately, to the much of the chagrin of sports bettors. But more on that on Wednesday. We'll be back with
Trevor Lawrence to be a little more accurate, too.
Oh,
missed some opportunities there.
You couldn't have dropped the ball into the bucket. Travis Etienne will send you some sticka, my friend. Come on now. Let's get things going. But no crying over spilled milk around these parts. We know it is a marathon, not a sprint. Appreciate all of you guys and your continued support for the podcast. Like I said, we'll be back on Wednesday with Brad Powers breaking down the marquee matchups for College Football Week 3. And right back, same time, same place on Thursday for the National Football League. Best of luck with all of your investments, whichever directions you choose to go in, on Monday Night Football between the Seahawks and Broncos, and hopefully we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.